The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, this is Joe Campanelli, and you're listening to In the Drink. This is the show on the Heritage Radio Network that brings you all of the most exciting people in the drink world, from winemakers to brewers. We've even had a wine rep on, and today we have two of the people who are, I think, some of the more influential and more exciting people in the Brooklyn restaurant scene. We have Doug Crowell from Buttermilk Channel in Carroll Gardens, one of my favorite restaurants. Just doing an all-American wine list. It's absolutely exciting. He's the service director and co-owner. And then we also have another service director and owner of the Brooklyn Star. We have Bill Reed. Brooklyn Star is just a great restaurant in Williamsburg. And things I love about it is they have a concise list, a concise menu, and everything on there is delicious, and it's there for a reason. Anyway, I'm excited to have both of you guys here.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Good morning. So I wanted to talk to you guys both about a topic that is fresh on my mind, especially with the opening of our new restaurant, La Picho, coming up, the domestic, the American wine scene. Both of you have made conscious efforts to feature only domestic wines. And in the world of wine and with new regions emerging all over the place, I think that is that's something that is a bit of a self-imposed challenge. And I want to know why have you both made this decision? What do you think the American wine scene is all about right now?
Sure, I'll go first. You know, we're an American bistro. So, you know, like a French bistro, which serves, which is in an urban environment, like say you're in a French bistro in Paris, you're serving sort of regional country food of France. And you know, if you were in a Paris bistro, you'd be drinking French wines. So it made sense to us that we would serve the regional wines of America alongside the, you know, regional cuisine of America.
Yeah, I think the same as far as our menu is concerned. It really complements what we're doing, all American food forward, and then also, you know, complementing that with an all American wine list really made sense for us. Originally, we did not open with that concept. My idea of wine was very open to French, Italian varietals, and West Coast wines in general if they were coming from the States. However, being I guess in New York for about eight years, you can find that there's such great wine locally in New York, upstate, or whether it be the Finger Lakes, and that kind of sparked my interest into American wines more, and being able to travel around the country to taste food and complementing our high fatty foods with high acidic wines. I think America is really showing a great example of how that is going.
Yeah, but and you mentioned the Finger Lakes. I think that's a region that there's kind of a renewed excitement about right now, especially New York sommeliers and beverage directors and just diners in New York who want to eat something that's produced locally. I think it's an exciting area. What are some of the other regions, Bill, that you think are exciting in the United States? Who do you think is doing some interesting things?
Besides from you know, Oregon. I really think that wines coming out of Idaho, which is very similar weather terroir to that you'll find close to that north kind of western region. Texas, when I visited Texas to kind of get inspired for our menu and to kind of see where the chef was from and inspired by in Austin, I found a really awesome Solero winery down there that is doing great things with Italian and Spanish grape varietals. As far as down as Maryland, Virginia, places that, whether it be because of global warming, sad to say, but in a good way, it's kind of helping out all American wines. Arizona, for example, people don't realize that microclimate there and volcanic ash soil is really helping the wine industry grow. I know obviously America has made a big step beyond California, and I feel that the faster it's growing so fast. I mean, now in the number two, New York is the number two wine growing region in the States, and that's something to be said about how passionate people are and how what great winemakers are coming over from these European countries and regions that are really leaving their mark and impression on our soil.
Wow, Doug, I'm going to pose the same question to you.
Wow, that was some states I didn't even know. I mean, I was aware that all 50 states make wine, but I haven't tasted wine from some of those places.
Yeah, I was going to give you a different question, but since Bill had such interesting, such unique areas, I think he's left a lot of the more conventional or places we might normally think of open. But maybe in the states of California and Washington, Oregon, are there certain areas of those states that maybe you're more interested in?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of great stuff happening on the Sonoma coast. You know, there's just a lot of wonderful little microclimates there where that great for a wide variety of grape varieties there. I think the Sierra and the Sierra foothills have got a few great producers there that are like, you know, it's high altitude and it's a little cooler. There's just a lot of wonderful little microclimates in California where people are making excellent wine in the Finger Lakes. I do think that's a real exciting region. You know, again, that has a focus. Yeah. You know, we make great Riesling in the Finger Lakes, which is also what's great about Oregon. I mean, Oregon Pinot Noir just gets better and better, and it's just really wonderful stuff there.
Yeah, and then that's something that that Bill mentioned about his food. You know, I'm actually staring at the menu right now. It all sounds delicious, but yeah, it is kind of a richer cuisine, and you wouldn't think traditionally that acid would be something that's associated with American wines, but you know, as a beverage director, that's something that we look for.
That can be harder to come by, and that's why we're looking to those cooler climates, and why great new winemakers are looking to cooler climates.
Doug, what's one of your favorite pairings on your list? One of your favorite wine and food pairings?
Wow. You've got to drink chicken and waffles with a wine I brought in today. This is something I'm really excited about. It is a wine from one of the funkier states that you were talking about. Is we've got on our list right now a Carbonic Frontenac from Maryland.
Wow.
Which is from Jenny and Francois are bringing that in.
Which I'm is jealous like, because I that was sold out.
Yes,
I bought it. Ordered and sold out.
I bought it. I mean, really, yeah, he made like three barrels of it.
Yeah.
But it's like, I mean, if I were to taste you blind on it, you would have to assume it was Beaujolais because it's really in that cat, and we serve it chilled. So just like light, awesome, fresh, fruity, great acidity. That to me is a great pairing.
That and the chicken waffles.
That and chicken and waffles, yeah.
Yeah, that's killer. And you guys also have a pretty incredible beer selection on the list, and so I think that with any of those beers with the chicken waffles dish that you guys do would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, beer and cider also.
How about you, Bill? What's your favorite pairing right now on your menu?
I would have to go with our Blaufränkisch from the Finger Lakes. That goes really well with either our fried green tomato dish, which has a really rich duck confit. It's kind of broken up by a little bit of the smoked molasses vinaigrette. The Blaufränkisch really cuts through a lot of that fat on that dish. Also, I'd probably have to say the Riesling that I brought today for you guys to taste from Idaho really goes well with a cherry tomato salad, something super high in acidity. The Riesling is about 95% Riesling, 5% Muscat, so it does have a tad bit more sugar, a little sweeter on the back end to kind of really help equal out those fatty acids that are going to be accompanying with our food.
That's just really exciting. I don't think I've ever had an Idaho wine. That's just super exciting. I can't wait to taste it. You know what? Let's just pour it out. We usually wait till the second part of the segment, but God, I can't wait. I'm super excited to try that. That's Sawtooth Vineyard Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
In the screw cap.
Screw cap, you know, trying to leave less of a carbon footprint, trying to save the cork trees. A lot of customers that don't know too much about wine may think right off the bat that the cork is going to make or break the wine because they're so used to seeing a cork. Most of our wines, I would say, out of the 21 on our list, probably about 18 are screw capped. Which also helps with aging. You're never going to have a corked wine. You're going to get a lot of the CO2 out of the bottle. And I think this wine really is quite nice. A little bit sweeter on the back. On the front, you're gonna really smell really good tropical aromas. You know, you're gonna get some pineapple in there. You're gonna get some banana, maybe depending on how early it is or how late it is. But this wine really goes well with our oysters. It goes well with our romaine salad, which has once again a little bit of fat to it with a bacon buttermilk dressing. Things that can really break down the dish and not so much stand up alone. Some of these wines on our list are great to drink by themselves, but I find a lot of American wines go so much better with food. A lot of French wines, I find you can really just have an outstanding Beaujolais or a Gamay grape or something that just you could just drink all night by itself. And it's definitely a daunting task, I should say, that finding American wines that kind of can fit within a budget of a new restaurant and also get in the consumer's hands and kind of educate them. It's actually a lot easier than I thought, because a lot of these neighborhoods have folks, you know, out of town from Idaho, from Arizona, visiting from Maryland. Visiting
that is for sure
from
who's buying the Idaho
Oregon. Yeah. You know, and it's and this Idaho Riesling is actually on our Buy the Glass list. And I would say, surprisingly enough, it was my wild card, educating staff on why it works and how these mountain ranges in the Sawtooth area of Snake River Valley. There's so many vineyards there that no one knows about. There's about 50 that are just there that people don't really get to try the wine because people don't know it's there or not interested in trying something that's not California or not New York.
Cool thing about Brooklyn is that people are really interested in trying something new. So, you know, you could put like, you know, funky grape varieties that go on the menu. You know, people see Carignan and they don't know what that is, but they're far more willing to try that than to go for Merlot. You know, so it can be both a good and a bad thing, because the thing that kills me is Chardonnay. It's like I'll find Chardonnays that I'm really in love with, and they're a tough sell because people have a bias against Chardonnay.
Wow, that's.
But people are really interested in trying new things in Brooklyn, so that gives us, you know,
yeah, definitely
the ability to sell Idaho wine.
The Brooklyn scene is very educated. Mm-hmm. New York in general is very educated about wine. And to kind of break it down into more simpler forms, not just for the guests but for staff. A lot of your wine knowledge and how you sell wine is how much your staff is involved in it and their training. I found that trying to teach staff about little regions or Provence or somewhere where they can barely pronounce the name is very hard for them to sell the wine and get it in the person's hands, especially if they know what if they don't know as much as what they're talking about. But talking about states that my staff's from. I have a lot of people from California that work for us. I have some folks from Maryland. I have some folks from Washington. So it's very easy for them to say, you know what? I know where Cochise is in Arizona, and I lived a few miles from there when I was going to school. And it's very easier to them to learn and to kind of pass it on the knowledge of these wines as opposed to something so out there.
You know, that's such a good point. It's something that I don't think about, but it just dawned on me yesterday at our staff training for La Picho. I was describing a wine from El Dorado County in California, and one of the staff members was just like, yeah, you know, you just drive right by that hotel, and then it's just past those hills, and that's where it is. And describe me to someone else who's also from California, and they actually knew that area a lot better than I did. And that certainly wouldn't happen if I was talking about a wine from like Valle d'Aosta in, you know, the Swiss Italian Alps.
It's not likely. Are you? Do you have a lot of American wines on your new list?
So our new list is going to be a third American wines and two thirds Italian.
I wish I could see. I'm looking forward to see what you pick.
Yeah, it's just going to be the wines that you guys have on your list. No, I'm just kidding.
If there aren't some repeats, I'd be almost offended.
For sure there are. So one of the things I want to ask you guys about is on my all Italian lists, I always have a hard time trying to find wines that a wine to pour by the glass that is rosé and sparkling. Right, because you want it on your list. You have to have a variety of styles, and if you're limiting yourself to having a point of view, and you're going to focus on just one type of wine, the one type of wine that I have a hard time finding is a sparkling rosé. that is Italian and that I think is good quality. I mean, there's Italian sparkling rosé that is very expensive, and there's Italian sparkling rosé that's just like that's just inexpensive and not delicious. But to find a delicious by the glass one, so
you really had to search to find something that was missing from Italian wine.
Yes, that's true. There's
you got everything.
Yeah, Italian has everything from light and crisp to the fullest and richest and everything in between. But limiting yourself to American wines, Doug, what is there a style that people ask for or that you're trying to find that you find it challenging?
Absolutely. Although generally it's something that great winemakers are working on already. Fortunately, I was drinking like a sparkling Malvasia the other night, and I thought like, this is like, it would be so awesome to have like Cremante Eldorado, you know, like a non champagne grape, based like rustic, high acid sparkling wine. That would be awesome. I have filling that inexpensive high acid white niche, like something by the glass. That can be tough,
right? And we were actually Doug came in for dinner on Monday night, so we can kind of go over a couple things and we actually share the same love for our by the glass pour. He actually has a sparkling rosé, which I flirted around with in bringing in from Gruet, which is actually in New Mexico. A lot of people don't know that New Mexico can produce fine wines, and this amazing family uprooted and moved everything that they had, whether it be the siblings or family members, and went down there and kind of made this whole scene.
Yeah, I thought we might cheat and serve champagne, but then finding Gruet and Schramsberg, you know, one of the oldest vineyards in America.
Right.
There's good sparkling stuff. Yeah.
So Doug on his list has the sparkling rosé. And I have the Blanc Noir by the glass pour. And it's something that's very, we were laughing about it. We almost kind of gave ourselves a crutch by doing an all-American wine list and kind of went against the grain by doing so. However, it's very inspirational in a lot of ways.
I think one thing that we both said that we're doing is people, our customers unfortunately can't really know how great the prices are, because we both end up, you know, finding things that don't really fit like that by the glass price, and being like, I just want to serve that, like, so we'll just make a little less money here or make a little less money there. It's just that's the price crutch is a thing.
Right.
One of the things I appreciate about both of your lists is that, you know, your by the glass wines are just ridiculously reasonably priced. They're just there's barely anything over like $10 or $11.
Well, we're in a different neighborhood than your place.
Than the West.
Exactly.
But I mean, I think that's great. I think that's a great service to people who want to try many different things, who want to drink, and there's a lot of good things.
I've caught a lot of slack for that, though. I don't know if you have, Doug, by your winemakers or reps that come to visit. They want to know why you're selling their wine at a more inexpensive price as opposed to other restaurants who may carry it throughout the rest of the country.
That's interesting. And mostly people are just jazzed that we're selling a ton of it.
Yeah, well, they don't want you
to devalue their brand.
They don't want to devalue it, but at the same time, it's my job to get it in the customer's hands. Our restaurant is super neighborhoody, very similar to Doug's, where we live and die by the neighborhood. Our food is inexpensive. So for me to have a $14 glass of wine, where they may just be tempted to have one, well, they can have a few glasses of wine for $8 or $9. We actually, our happy hour is half off all of our wines by the glass. So they become $4 or $5 a glass.
I think something that we know that not everyone listening might know is that you might expect selling wines from this country, you would have a price advantage.
Right.
And that's the sort of ironic thing is that because of our three-tier distribution system, like, I can't buy direct from a distributor except for people in New York. So ironically, wines from America can be more expensive, and for other reasons too, because we've got, you know, nobody here has got land that's been in the family for 500 years, and labor's expensive and your kid's going to an expensive college or whatever it is. But so American wines, they can be expensive. There's so many awesome inexpensive Italian
options. As you've both proven, they can also be absolutely delicious. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Bill Reed and Doug Crowell here on In the Drink. Just circles on the
map. Just circles. You're listening to Wilderness Tips and Cookies on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Cherry lemon, aren't you black? Cherry, aren't you black?
I'm feeling good.
Today's program has been brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run commercial offset print house that brings together environmentally friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Founded in 1998 by Eugene Lee and his father, Cam Lee, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and green technology. Rolling Press prints using soy and vegetable inks, uses a variety of certified and recycled papers, and they incorporate a chemical-free production process. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
All right, and welcome back. This is Joe Campanelli for In the Drink. I'm here with Doug Crowell of Buttermilk Channel in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, and Bill Reed of the Brooklyn Star in Williamsburg, and we're talking about American wines. Both of these gentlemen feature wine lists that are entirely American and nothing else, and that's really exciting. Before we left for break, Doug said that we're opening up a new restaurant, La Picho, and he said if there aren't some of the same American wines on the list, then he'd be insulted. So I had a chance to take a look at his list over break, and there are certainly quite a few. Just off the top of my head, we'll definitely have there's the Brock Cellars, Dunking Goat, Bonnie Dune, Copane. Yeah, there's. I think I one of the places that I learned about how great American wine could be are my meals at Buttermilk Channel. I think I was a skeptic until finding a list like this, and I think it's really inspirational. So thank you for that.
I was considering bringing that wine from one of those wines from Palmina there. I thought, how will Joe take to a Nebbiolo from America? Those are pretty wonderful.
They're pretty wonderful. Yeah, you know, I just tasted the Palmina 2007 Nebbiolo last week. I don't know if you guys have that on your list.
I've got 06.
You have 06.
I've got 03 sitting there, yeah. I think the best American wines, those are like, you know, is it indistinguishable from a Barolo? Would you confuse it? You know, mm-hmm. I tasted them. Those actually blind in a lineup of Barolos. And, you know, you're noticed, they're like, hey, there's a lot of fruit in this wine. You know, so they're distinctly American. But I think a great representative of the terroir and the grape variety.
Yeah, it totally blew my mind, because my line on Nebbiolo, when I describe Nebbiolo to people, is that it is the world class grape that is so finicky, it only grows in its one region and doesn't want to grow anywhere else. And when I tasted that, I was definitely a believer. So we're gonna actually have it out of Magnums, which I'm super excited about.
Awesome. Nice, nice.
Magnums of California Nebbiolo. I never thought I'd say that.
Go big or go home.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
So speaking of wine, what do we have in the glass right now? It looks like you guys just poured a little something for us.
I just poured the aforementioned Carbonic Frontenac from Maryland. So this is neat. This is, I mean, talking about what I wish we could find more of is like a simple, light, gulpable. I think it's better a little colder than this wine like this. So, you know, carbonic maceration is the process that's used a lot in Beaujolais and other, you know, regions to make sort of a rustic, fruity, light wine. Yeah, and they made very little of that, and we bought just about all of it.
Yeah, I mean, how many dry American wines are at 11.5% alcohol as well, which I think is, you know, it's a really nice thing. It's more food friendly, and you probably feel a little bit better the next day if you finish the bottle off. I think that's a really great thing. I don't know much about this Frontenac grape. How did it get?
It sounds French,
yeah,
but it is not. That's a hybrid grape. That is not Vitis vinifera. That's a hybrid grape variety that I assume like withstands the harsh weather in Maryland.
Yeah, and it's a local Maryland hybrid grape.
Yeah, I don't know what has been hybridized.
Yeah, one of the things I love about Doug is that he's one of my resources for American wine history. It just definitely is one of the things that he's most interested in. Doug, what can you tell us a little about Maryland in general?
I can tell you about American wine history, but not about Maryland.
I'm like,
not about Maryland. Although American wine history, doesn't necessarily start in California. You know, we've got Thomas Jefferson is planting grapes in Virginia, and one of the things interesting about American wine history is sort of, looking at these wines, it's a really recent history. You know, American, right. The New World wines are really new. I mean, you know, we can look back to, like, you know, the 17th century and monks planting stuff in California. But, you know, we got hit by phylloxera like the rest of the world, and we got hit by prohibition where we had to uproot all of our vineyards in the you know, early part of the 20th century. So, and then, you know, into the 60s, we're still making like mostly fortified wines and sweet wines, and growing in California a lot of these big productive varieties like Colombard and Carignan that are not
right.
making awesome wines usually. So the history of wine in America is really recent, and a lot of these producers that we're in love with like have been making wines for a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. However, I always like to say, you know, when you look at the rest of the world, there's a sort of image that in these old world wine regions, they've been making wine in the same way for hundreds and hundreds of years, and that's not really true either. Actually, the whole world of wine is changing, you know, is all changing together. Just, you know, different production techniques like... You know, are we using new wood barrels where we used to old? You know, we used to reuse our barrels, and also whether we like it or not, because of global warming, because mm-hmm. the whole world is getting warmer.
Right, mm-hmm. and definitely, it's a race to see who can be as the greenest winery or sustainable winery, and growing techniques are definitely having certain labels on your wine saying that you are, whether it be LEED. Green or whatever it may be certified. I think that a lot of wineries are in America are taking it to the next step because a lot of our food we want to see organic. We want to see that it's fresh and it's farm to table food in a lot of restaurants in New York, but it should also be farm to table wine. And I think that's another passionate example of why we do American wines, because it doesn't take that long for it to get from the vine to our glass, right. Which is something that's very special.
Right. I mean, especially if you're on the East Coast or close by, though. From what I understand, if you're bringing wine from California, that's a pretty similar carbon footprint to right. to European wine. Right.
That yeah, that's not really your advantage there. No. Right.
Well, let's try one more. We have one or two more wines coming up. What do we have here?
Yeah, we have this winery is actually holds a special place in my heart. Because me and my wife took a trip out to Oregon to do some wine research and to taste some amazing food, and we stumbled upon this vineyard here, Van Duzer. It's right off of the Van Duzer corridor, so it's going to see a very consistent cool climate. This happens to be from their Dijon blocks. Actually, if you know Dijon blocks. Number 113 and 117, if you get very specific. They are very small operation. This is only 125 cases, which is definitely something that is awesome in its own right. This vintage is definitely one of the better ones for that year. It was super cool. And I think that this wine really pairs well with all of our food from the lighter dishes to the heavier dishes. This is actually our most expensive bottle of wine.
I was noticing that. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's really generous of you.
Thank you.
So people for in having Brooklyn us. Really dig Oregon Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
That is and rightfully so, because it's there's just really, really wonderful stuff out there.
Bill, it's almost twice as expensive as any other wine on your list. Do you find that people are open to spending? It's $85 on your list,
right?
Do you find that people are open to spending that? Do you feel like, are people asking for more expensive options as well?
Well, what happened was we had a big budget in the beginning for wine, and then noticing that $10, $11, and $12 glasses were not what people were looking for, because our food was so accommodating to the price range. Our food is, as everyone dig in and share, it's very, they're composed dishes, but they're meant to be shared by at least two people. All of our items, there's not one dish on there that one person can easily manage to eat. So the prices went down to accommodate groups, you know, drinking a bottle of wine or two bottles of wine. I actually had the Van Duzer Estate Pinot Noir, which is a blend of all their Pinot Noir grapes, and that was only $50 a bottle. I had such a strong following for that wine, and people from Van Duzer contacted me and said, you know, you're doing an amazing job with this wine. I just want you to try this. And this was after I tasted it. It's a little bit more on the earthier side, but it still remains a lighter style Pinot Noir. And I found that once I put it on the list, and it should be higher than 85 mm-hmm. for sure for what we pay for it. But once again, getting it in the consumer's hand is more important. This wine at $85 is a steal for a couple friends to have a few glasses, and it's an example of a great Pinot Noir from Oregon for sure.
What people are also willing to spend a little more money, which because you have to, is a great classic California Cabernet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Which is you know, something I'd also like to give a shout out to. It's not just like, you know, the new funky wine producers that are doing one. There's your most established style of wine and grape variety in California, and that's something we have to charge a little more for. But that's yeah. really wonderful.
And I see you have some of the library release of Kathy Corazon.
Yeah.
Wow.
We just opened up one of those this weekend. That's just beautiful. And Maya Camus and Frog's Leap mm-hmm. and Ridge and you know, just the real classic American Cabernets, and people are really receptive to those and are willing to pay a little more for them, and I've been really happy to see that because those are beautiful.
And sometimes you go out, you know, you have your guests who are looking for, you know, from our glass pours, which are $9 to $40 a bottle, and then we have our bottle range is only $5 to $10 more than our glass pour range. So it's very, you know, if somebody wants to try something different, it's not going to be like pulling teeth for them to, you know what, it's a little tight this month, or it's the first of the month, and people are really willing to spend more if it means more to them, and they can kind of we can represent that with the food as well. So
right, can you get, you know, one of the things I appreciate about both of your lists is that it is just well edited, that everything is on the list, it seems to me, at least for a reason. There's no kind of throwaway wine, and I find that for me as a wine buyer, that's a challenge to make sure that everything has a purpose and that there's a reason. And there's so many wines that all of us, you know, are so excited about, and just focusing it and narrowing it down to a list that is concise and is easy for the customers. So I appreciate that about both of your lists.
I tried to make the font smaller and the margins narrower, but I can't do it. So I can't have any more wines.
It's by design, based on the size of your menu, is what you're saying.
No, it makes sense for us.
It's one of the things I really appreciate. Here's another wine that Doug might have brought, this one,
yeah.
D. This is a wine that we're going to have on our list. Definitely their Chenin Blanc, but this is...
I love the Chenin Blanc. I know, so I don't have that right now. I wish I could get that.
What is this right here?
Liu Di, so this is a collaboration between Justin Will of Tyler Wines and Eric Railsback, who's a great sommelier. Oops, sorry, Bill. In California, and these guys are making all Loire Valley grape variety wines, so that wonderful Chenin Blanc and Sauvignon Blanc and this Cabernet Franc, and just really picking earlier than anyone else out there, and making you know, high acid, low alcohol, really drinkable, delicious wines. That, I mean, that to me is like, that is a quintessential Cabernet Franc right there.
Yeah, I mean, Cabernet Franc is a grape that I absolutely love only in the Loire Valley, usually, because it's, you have such insane amounts of value. You have such terroir-driven wines that cost very, very, very little, that I find that usually when people bring it out of the Loire, they try to treat it more like Cabernet Sauvignon and make it ripe and, right. and oaked up. But one of the things I love about this is that it really is true to what I really like about Cabernet Sauvignon or Cabernet Franc. That is, it's just like easygoing. It's light. It's refreshing. It's terroir specific. Has a little spiciness to it. It's just a really fun wine.
And again, a new. I mean, this is their, how many vintages do they have? This is like not many.
Yeah, so it's only going to get better, is what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I just think it's just amazing that this is a, you know, that this is a new wine. That, you know, I mean, how many Italian wineries do you have on your list that have been making wine for only a few years? Probably not very many.
Not very many at
or
all.
Or if they are, like, they're like, oh, I know, there's like an awesome like zillion year old vineyard over here. I'll just like buy their grapes.
Okay, guys, we're gonna finish up with a little quick rapid fire question. I'm gonna ask you, which American wine would you drink in the following scenarios? Okay, so we'll start off just really easy. You're going to the beach, you're having a little picnic. What American wine? Let's start with you, Bill.
White or red? Does it matter?
Your call.
If I'm going to the beach, it's gonna be hot, so yeah. I'm gonna go with a rosé.
With a rosé. Do you have a particular American rosé that you got?
Of course. The Wrath Rosé from Monterey. The Pinot Noir grape is just really stunning, and it can go. It's crisp. It's a little bit acidic, and the Pinot Noir really comes through. I think if I'm going to the beach with my lady, that's what I'm going to bring. Rosé. I'm going to bring.
All right, Doug. Easy one for you too. Picnic with some friends. American wine.
But we're on the beach, right?
Like your picnic on the beach.
I'm picnicking on the beach. So I'm imagining we get this from Donkey and Goat, this Marsan and Grenache Blanc blend that they've got, which is just like got tremendous minerality and just really high acid and fun. And I'm imagining taking the whole keg and putting it in the ocean and running a line up to my blanket.
That'd be nice.
All right, we're gonna step it up a little bit. How about a trip to the Grand Canyon?
The Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna bring a cab franc from New York City. I'm going to bring a little bit of earthiness there. I'm going to bring a little cooler, a little funk. I think that New York is really represented well with that grape varietal for sure.
All right. Doug, Grand Canyon.
Let's take like one of these Sierra Foothills wines and like see, you know, like the Cuvée Mystérieuse we've got here from Closer On. Let's like take one of those there and see what that funky climate does to a wine that's made with almost no sulfur.
All right, guys, that was awesome. So we're gonna have to wrap up now, but thank you both so much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Pioneers of American wine in Brooklyn. We have Doug Crowell of Buttermilk Channel out in Carroll Gardens.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's been fun.
And Bill Reed at the Brooklyn Star in Williamsburg. Go to their restaurants, drink American wines on their list, and listen to In the Drink on Heritage Radio. We'll see you next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Heritage Radio Network is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices with Stitcher. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.